This is an example of speech.
All our history of broiling wars.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge. Thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard, evergreen topical heatwave of a weekly conversation turned podcast in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comment sections in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter, at Bloated Nemesis, and I have with me, as always, and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter, at GreenWeird, and once again, Dave Egan, who can be found on Twitter, at DrunkleOcetus. This episode, we have our weekly intro segment, Weak Thoughts, about the rot in the Republican Party and Eritrean spies in Europe, a deeper dive into Russian mercenary operations in Syria, a Tell Me What to Watch segment on Black Panther, a rant about Peter Thiel company Palantir, a lack of elections being held in Wisconsin, and in a special Supreme Court segment, we discuss Janice versus Ask Me and two immigration-related rulings. Prepare to get royally revolutionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think. Now for some weak thoughts.
I've kind of had this question on my mind for a few weeks now. Well, honestly, probably a few years. It's been percolating in the back of my head, but the gun control debate has really it has been a good example of it. So I'm going to ask it now. There, to most objective observers, who are not a cult member of the Republican Party, there seems to be a flaw, a problem with it. It seems corrupt, and not just financially, but almost like ideologically corrupt. And so I'm wondering, is this a flaw in the party, or is it a feature? Is it like the point of it? And I mean, probably neither answer is totally right or wrong, but I don't know. What do you think?
This is kind of a result of them being a big tent party. Like, their attempt to include, like, just disparate elements of their ideology under the same ideological, you know, overarching concept. Because there's some very real and dangerous contradictions between zealous social conservatism and hyper-capitalist conservatism. For one, the two opinions or the two ideological viewpoints have radically different opinions on the power of the state towards individuals and towards the commercial sector. Like the hyper-capitalists would want no government involvement in anything and no taxes, but if you talk to some social conservatives, abortion and things like that, they want strong government regulation and intrusive into people's privacy and individual choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's a feature and a flaw?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say in no way, shape, or form is it a flaw, again, unless you're a cult member of the Republican Party. But I think you're totally right about this big tent, about this coalition. That is a very explicit thing. I was just listening to a talk by Grover Norquist recently.
That guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he's a smart guy. And I mean, this will go a little bit off topic for a second, but part of his background was building an anti-communist coalition in primarily Angola, but a couple other countries.
Jesus.
Back in like the 80s or 70s.
Ugh.
And the reason it ties in is because he said in this interview, which was on the Ezra Klein podcast, was that he thinks of, and Ezra Klein kind of kept pushing him, like, why you? Why did you do that? What is your strength? And he said, my ability is to build a coalition. That's his ability. And what has he been doing for the past,
3 decades?
Yeah, in American politics is building this big tent conservative party. And I think that combined with the faith element, bringing in that social conservative, that Christian, I mean, nothing against Christianity in and of itself by any means, certainly, but bringing in that faith element and now putting this element of faith into all of these issues, into like even fiscally, like somehow they have a faith based zealotry for less taxes, which is actually back to Grover Norquist. Like, that's this whole thing. Like, it's always good to never raise taxes. You should never, ever, under any circumstances, raise taxes. And it just strikes me as like a dogma rather than a policy.
Oh, absolutely. That guy is like Hughes to his fanatical dogmatic point, which is, you know, the absolute elimination of taxes. But yeah, it's tough to square that idea with, like, I don't know, what was that verse about in the New Testament? Something about some carpenter saying, give the ruler his due or something?
Yeah, he must have been one of the minor characters.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
I love that word, big tent, bringing in a coalition of sometimes opposing views is what really came to the forefront in the 90s, mm-hmm, once they firmly got those Christians
on board.
Yeah, the religious right mixed with the fiscal conservatives and just stirred those fuckers together. And it's just been a little crazy since then. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a feature, but it's a result of the whole basis of it.
Right.
The whole idea behind what they're doing has to be this way. There's no other way for it to work.
Well, it's because neither of these, especially now that they're rigidly dogmatic, neither of the aspects of the party has that mass appeal that could win an election. That was basically Reagan's innovation, though. He was the conservative warrior who pulled on the robe of Peter and tried to fight the good fight against the communists, I guess. Which, you know, also helped him burnish his capitalist credentials.
Reagan benefited from a divided Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was... I would say that he was the one that pulled the Christians off of the Democrat Party.
Well, but specifically in 1980... I mean, Carter did not have, by measures of polling and popularity, Carter did not have a popular presidency.
No.
You can argue about the policy and whatnot, but just in terms of what the public at the time thought, it was not popular. And it was not popular both, obviously, from the right, but was also not popular from the left. And so they had an extremely contentious, divided convention. You know, from what I understand, it puts 2016 to shame a little bit. Between Ted Kennedy, who is kind of from the further left, and Carter. And there were a lot of people who didn't vote for Carter in the general. There was like some kind of more left third party candidate that ran. It was actually a former Republican who then moved further to the left of Carter. It's weird. And he took a lot of votes from Carter, who otherwise might have beaten Reagan.
That makes me sick to my stomach.
And then, yeah, I mean, it's... And so, speaking of autocratic regimes, you want to talk about Eritrea and their, there's some reports that they have spies?
Yeah, it's a fascinating report by Al Jazeera that came out a few days ago. It sounds like the government of Eritrea, since at least 2013, has been infiltrating their own, well, sympathists or maybe even intelligence agents into the language services of European countries. Which may seem innocuous, but Eritrea has a unique language that, you know, you have to have an interpreter for to, for instance, file refugee documents or, you know, otherwise interact with a European government, because obviously they don't come in speaking Italian or English or French or German.
And
so,
well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, why would they want? Why would the government be doing that? What's their angle?
They apparently expropriate a percentage tax on expats, like 2% of the income of people who are living overseas.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Which is highly illegal.
How is that enforced?
Extortion. But Eritrea is, as you say, an authoritarian country, autocratic. They are perhaps one of the worst places in the world. And I, of course, don't say that lightly. Mm-hmm. Because... up until the age of 35, every Eritrean citizen is obligated to state service, compulsory state service.
Okay.
So, not only a draft, but almost outright slavery to the government.
Yeah.
And, hell, this is why Europe created Fortress Europe. They have always had a problem since, like, 91 with Eritrean refugees, people trying to flee and escape.
They've had this system for that long.
Right, the same guy who cut the country off of Ethiopia is still in charge.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that government and that regime and that military policy would both lead to a lot of people trying to flee, so there'd be a lot of refugees. And then also it would lead to probably a lot of people working for the government, because it goes so long in their military and intelligence, and so they'd have a lot of spies to throw at this. And from the article, it seemed to me that they also had the angle of trying to, like, a little bit of an information war, which is trying to undercut the amount of reports coming out of torture and other atrocities.
Right, and based on, well, refugee laws, these people have to apply with these European governments and the European Union for asylum based on, you know, political prosecution or various other things that almost certainly are happening in Eritrea. And so with these translators, like, they wouldn't be telling the government the whole story. They would say, oh, this guy is just complaining, so you shouldn't take him seriously, and you should just send him back to Eritrea.
Oh, okay, so get some to go back. That mm-hmm. makes sense.
And one other thing is that using these intelligence operatives and sympathizers, they can take names. The highly autocratic and authoritarian government in Eritrea, of course, has everybody's name on a list, and if they find out that somebody, you know, left the country and is trying to create problems, they can, you know, try to find your weaknesses or weak points that are still in the country.
Oh, yeah, family members, and, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. For the Europeans, it presents another interesting and tangled, thorny quandary in that there are foreign agents who are trying to subvert their governmental functions.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to, if in the United States wouldn't necessarily be a problem so much as if those people just filed as foreign agents, but without that, you know, legalistic that legalistic protection, those people are just unauthorized intelligence agents, so...
Mm-hmm. I mean, the article alluded to, some complaints being filed that were ignored. I mean, it seems like a lot of times we talk about things where there's not an easy solution, but this one seems like there actually could be a solution that's not that difficult, which is just mostly the Italian government, but it's not limited to them. It's just that that's where a lot of them come into Europe from. So mostly them, but just has to do their due diligence on the interpreters they hire, especially when there are complaints lodged against them.
And apparently they do at least background checks, but I don't understand how these people would have slipped through other than, like, I guess prevailing intelligence architecture, like a series of people that could vouch for them falsely, which leads to, of course, other problems.
Well, yeah, especially if they have, like, if they're throwing a bunch of people at this, then, you know, it might spread beyond the interpreters. I mean, how many of the refugees themselves, I mean, not to get, like, too paranoid about refugees, but, I mean, there could be, they said, like, on that boat, the article begins with a boat that,
lands off in an Italy off of a, or lands on an island off of Italy.
Yeah, everyone died.
Most people died. There were survivors.
Okay. A lot of people. But it was like over 300 died or something. And they brought in some, most of them were Eritreans, and so they brought in some Italian Eritreans to I don't know, help identify the bodies or something like that.
And translate.
Oh, yeah. And they're like, almost all these people work for the government. Like, they knew a lot of them.
Work for the youth wing of the party.
So, I mean, not that that's necessarily representative of every boat that comes, but it could be a bigger thing than a handful of interpreters. Which, if that's the case, that's not an easy thing to solve.
Right, I mean, what do? You reject the refugees outright? Which seems antithetical to humanitarian values, or you just let all of them in and create other problems? Personally, I'd go for the latter, but...
Well, go for the latter and, you know, hire a few extra people to make sure that the people you're paying, your government is paying to be interpreters, or whoever else that works around the refugees, are doing their job right. Have a little oversight, for God's sakes.
Or just involvement in the community. It seems like a lot of these refugees are either just put in, like, these repatriations or integration centers and basically otherwise ignored.
I'm thinking of joking Italian repatriation services. It's like, stare at the Mona Lisa and then eat a bunch of spaghetti. I shouldn't make jokes like that.
Might have to cut that one out.
Yeah, I'll cut it. play Mario.
I was going to say, this kind of leads me to another question, is how we don't necessarily get as many Eritrean refugees over here in the United States because it's just significantly more difficult. But,
just, like, logistically, you mean?
Right. They'd have to, like, fly to somewhere in Central America and then walk across Guatemala and Mexico to reach our southern border. But most of them would go to Canada anyway, anymore. But this is, how much is this happening in the United States? Are our asylum processes also being subverted in the interests of a authoritarian, backwards government?
Well, we know that, except it's just our government, but yeah. well, that's a good question to end on. And speaking of cordoned off African nations, we'll be back with a talk about Wakandan politics.
I thought it was a incredibly well put together, coherent narrative. Like, you usually don't see that in movies. Like, usually, like, there's like a contradiction about the villain that you just kind of have to put behind the fourth wall or whatever.
Yeah.
But this time, the villain was almost more compelling than the main character, and which leads me to the interesting ambiguity as to the reference of Black Panther. Was that supposed to be Killmonger or T'Challa?
The bad guy?
Yeah.
The bad guy is Killmonger.
No, that's what I'm saying. Oh. Black Panther, the name of the movie, is that referencing Killmonger or T'Challa?
Well, I would say T'Challa, because it's about the king, but yeah, I mean, it could apply to both. It could apply to both. Just as a movie as a whole, it's probably not my favorite Marvel movie in terms of humor, action, cinematography, a lot of like those filmmaking things. It was good. It just, I don't know that I loved some of that stuff, but to me, what you're bringing up, the villain, the main kind of thematic elements in the hero versus villain clash were excellent. Definitely the best for any Marvel movie, and I think I saw a reviewer say it might be the best since The Dark Knight, in terms of a comic movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely. This is definitely in that class. It's interesting you say about the kind of the production and directing elements. Now that you mention it, that is probably the only thing that I can say bad about this movie, is that they didn't use the CGI as well as some other Marvel movies have.
Yeah, and like that final fight is like really dark. It's like on that dark train train line. And it's just weird. I thought in general the action was less than, a lot of the Marvel movies, a lot of the point is the superpowers are, like the South Korean chase scene, that was pretty cool. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I would say that's about it in terms of action. The final battle is, there's very little for modern action movies that you would say like sticks out.
I guess this brings me to another complaint is, that final fight, they could have done more. If they both had like the agility and strength of Black Panther, they should have been bounding around that vibranium mine.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just sort of, it just lost a little bit. But nonetheless, I think the ideas in it were great. I mean, even the way they kind of wrapped him up at the end, because in the beginning of the movie, as they're sort of setting these thematic elements in place, I was like, this is a tough solution. Like, what do you do if you're running Wakanda? Because right in the beginning, his love interest says, essentially, his love interest has the same ideology as the main villain.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. Like, you don't see that in movies.
Right.
That's really novel. Which is, Wakanda should exert its power, not just power, but, its technology, its ideologies about governance, about, how people should be treated,
its resources.
Yeah, and it should be to help.
It's kind of a pro-African point, or a pan-African movement.
Yeah, it's not just to help the rest of Africa, but it's to help black people around the world, and you can sort of see it extrapolated to for minority groups around the world. So then the main villain is Killmonger, and he is totally African American. He was born in America, though he is Wakandan. His father, at least, is Wakandan.
Member of royalty, even.
Yes. And he has a sort of... Well, and that's kind of the interesting thing with the title, which is when, if you take the comic book character out of it, which actually predates the Black Panther Party, I will add. But if you take the comic book character out, an American that hears Black Panther thinks of a sort of radical black power movement, which has had varying degrees of radical over the years. But
there was a lot of that symbolism and, thematic elements in the movie, too.
Well, yeah, but you mostly see that with Killmonger.
is more.
Well, no, I would say he's more of the radical wing of the Black Panther Party that began emerging late in its existence.
Yeah.
And because the Black T'Challa is kind of emblematic of the original core doctrine. It was nonviolent, non-misogynist, like a like an international movement, but was hyper concerned with the concerns of a very select group of people, and that was African Americans in the United States, because the Black Panther Party started as a self-defense force.
Yeah, yeah.
And it later, you know, elements of it took up arms when they felt that their resistance wasn't accomplishing anything through the traditional nonviolent means, or prevailing nonviolent means.
And you could even see then that self-defense thing in what Wakanda is. Like, Wakanda, at the beginning of the movie, is all about defending itself to the extent that it hides itself.
Right, which is, you know, the Black Panthers advocated for even more than Dr. Martin Luther King and some of his contemporaries advocated for, like, the separation of the Black community from the rest of America, like, make it more insular.
Yeah, almost like a, fine, if we're going to be segregated, then let's... let's do this and benefit from it.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting doctrine that divides the two, and it's challenging. I mean, a lot of the people in Wakanda start supporting Killmonger. There's one main character.
Reasons.
Yeah, there's humanitarian reasons. There's sort of a little bit of a warmongering reason. But it's compelling. I mean, you have to, like, you're challenged to think why the villain's wrong. Like, you can see his methods are clearly wrong. You know, like, he's just going in there and burning and
he shoots
being a complete authoritarian. He's not a thoughtful king.
Yeah,
he's not an enlightened king.
And he will cut down any number of trees to save the forest, as emblematic of him shooting his own love interest in the forehead.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And so, I don't know. I thought that was fascinating between the two. And then it sort of actually brought in a little bit of a commentary on American politics apart from race.
Oh, right. Killmonger himself is a whole allegory for the American national state or national security complex. He is notionally the emblem of it, like the cutting edge of our darkest, deepest fucking secrets.
Yep, they bring up that he's a black ops, who's, you know, they have that CIA character who's like describing like what he's been trained to do. He's been trained to just tear apart governments, go in, take them over. And then also there's the issue that Wakanda, kind of broadly speaking, is dealing with is a lot like, the kind of mega American first thing. You know, like, there's radical elements in Wakanda, the love interest versus Killmonger, that kind of differ, but they're sort of the same. But then there's the conservative elements of Wakanda, want to keep them insular, put Wakanda first. We have to only protect ourselves. We don't owe anything to the rest of the world.
Oh, God.
And
that scene in the side character that you mentioned, how he was... So, yeah, we could talk about that as part of this. Like, in the first few scenes, that guy is like, sure, he kind of agrees with Killmonger and I forget what her name is in the story, but T'Challa's love interest, and is like, yes, if you want me to, we will absolutely leave Wakanda's borders to take a more proactive defense. Like, projecting power as a means of defense, which is another big part of our national security complex.
Yeah, and you see... I just want to get a... his love interest is Nakia.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to get that down.
Okay.
And she's a spy for Wakanda that goes around the world and kind of does humanitarian missions. And so that's kind of where she's coming from,
with, oh, we should, you know, we should go share our you know, good fortune with the rest of the world.
Oof.
And she's coming at it like, let's fight slavery and human trafficking and things like that.
I will say one note about that. It's, I'm not entirely sure her mission there was humanitarian. I think that she was there... Well, her own interest may have been humanitarian, but she, as a spy, was purely there to fucking get an idea of who those militants were and how strong they were.
Oh, that could be. Yeah, like, yeah.
That's why she was content to sit in the back of the truck and wait.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little hard to say on that one. She definitely has that instinct, though. That
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, she argues for it, but, you know, yeah. She, as a policy thing, she might not have, her orders might not have said that.
And then the other character that we're referencing is Wakabi. Hmm. Is the, he's from a border tribe, or the border tribe. And he's kind of the prominent one who sort of allies himself with Killmonger.
Right, Wakanda first, but... That's kind of another American allegory, isn't it? ICE that supports our radical dictator, our border tribe.
Hmm. Yep, yep.
Anyway,
yep. No, yeah. I mean, it layers in allegories, references to modern politics, and then big ideological differences that are challenging. That both sides seem have good points. I mean, think about what Killmonger, his main thing is he wants to give Wakandan weapons to, I guess, black people around the world who are repressed, these weapons to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And on one hand, well, they've never been able to, and maybe they should have the right to fight back. On the other hand, will that just lead to more war and misery for everyone? It's a tough one.
I don't know.
And I think what they kind of make, or what kind of justifies it, is that in the end, T'Challa realizes that not sharing anything with the rest of the world is no longer an option. At least in the wake of Killmonger. Because if he was to just completely retreat again, then you still have the same... structure in place for this divisiveness to happen again to them, and he might not win next time. Sure, it might not be Killmonger, but it could be someone else.
Right, it could be that guy in charge of the border tribe. Their next like formal challenge may take it up, or maybe every single one of them that challenges him for various reasons.
Yeah, yeah. What if they all challenge him one after another? Which is, I think, you could do at those ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's one way of forcing an impeachment.
Or even from the love... I'm terrible with these names. Even during the movie, I was like, I just wish I was... Nakia.
Mm-hmm.
Even from someone like Nakia could challenge him next time. And it's a lot harder to disagree with Nakia on the issue of sharing the wealth, so to speak.
Yeah, it sounds real tin-eared to be like, screw those poor oppressed people.
Yeah. No, and so then he's, you know, but he's doing it in a reasoned way at the end. He's, you know, I if I were to, like, put down on paper T'Challa's policies by the end and then after the end of the movie, it would still have strong national defense. He's not going to go light on that. By any means.
No.
But it's also a slow, measured, he's like, this will be the first, you know, they go to Oakland, this will be the first, whatever, it's like Wakandan Outreach Institute or whatever they call it.
Basically an embassy.
Yeah, and then we'll have another one, but it's not all at once, you'll learn lessons as you do more and more of them. Yeah.
He wouldn't have the infrastructure in place. I mean, spies aren't diplomats.
And what he's sharing is primarily culture and technology, or, you know, science. he's not just creating, like, arms manufacturers around the world. He's not Tony Stark here.
Right. If anything, he could use the lesson of Iron Man as, like, ooh, yeah, weapons, not a good idea.
Which they don't explicitly lay out in the movie, but his character would know that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, his character would be a little bit more allied with Captain America, right? If I'm remembering.
Mm-hmm. And that's where he ended up in Civil War.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot to take apart in the movie and to look at and to reflect on. I don't know. My last point will be that I think the White House really needs to have this as a movie night soon.
Okay. My last point, which is also another spoiler, is that Killmonger is the only villain in the entire MCU who got what he wanted by the end of the movie.
Yeah, well, not explicit, not the exact, but yeah, essentially, yeah. His goals, though in a slightly different way,
was
yeah.
just to open up Wakanda. Yep. And to get revenge for his father and make people realize the injustice of what happened. Well, I guess, cut print done. Way to go, Killmonger.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's not on the throne. He's, you know, he doesn't have that kind of personal satisfaction in terms of, being the man on the throne. It wasn't weapons that were sent out. But yeah, his goals were achieved. Yeah, no, he's a great villain. He's really great. I mean, just the way, too, like, you have all of this, these, like, African accents throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just have a guy that, like, at least to an American like me, I'm just like, oh, I can understand him really well.
That guy has a purely American accent.
Yeah, I don't know. It was just, he just was such a contrast to the rest of them.
Mm.
And it wasn't just that he had an American accent, it's just sort of like his like, nonchalant way of speaking. You know, like, know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It was just really interesting. He every scene with him was probably, you know, one of my favorite scenes.
Yeah, he was a really understated guy. A great show. Was,
yeah. All right.
Oh, and the music was on point.
Yeah, music was good. Definitely did that. That would be one of the stylistic elements that totally was great. Yeah. Was it a drilling operation? I think it was a drilling operation.
No, it was an American base. Near an oil-rich area.
Okay, I thought it was a... Okay, well, whatever. Something to do with oil. And there were a number of American troops there. And I assume some allied Syrians as well.
Yeah, I think it was FSA, or the Free Syrian Army.
And... some of Assad's forces and Russian mercenaries attacked them and got their ass handed to them. Apparently really badly, like hundreds
embarrassingly.
Dead. I mean, they were way underarmed. They had like, what, one tank or something?
Mm-hmm. And personal weapons, like assault rifles. I don't even think they had mortars or any other like, yeah, explosives.
Yeah, they said they didn't have surface-to-air missiles. They were way underarmed. So, no one really knows exactly who ordered this. Well, at least not in the public. I'm sure someone knows somewhere in the world. Knows who ordered it. Maybe more importantly, why it was ordered. You know, especially, I mean, you would have had to have the worst intelligence in the world to think that they would have succeeded.
Right, which leads me to believe that, okay, so a lot of people are quick to blame Russia on this, but there weren't Russian government asset was used in this. They didn't provide air support. They could have provided BMPs or other, like, field assets to support the operation, but they didn't. It was just a bunch of Russian mercenaries with Syrian government forces and their allies.
So you made an interesting comment to me that... okay, well, first let me just react to that, which is... Yes, I think there's arguments... I think there's sort of circumstantial evidence the other way, though, that it could have been ordered. You know, we don't really know. Whoever did it was stupid, and I guess you're assuming that the Russian government would be less likely to be stupid than just the business head of the mercenary wing or someone in the Syrian government?
Right.
You know, but I mean...
Because the Syrian government's operations throughout their entire civil war haven't exactly been imaginative.
Okay.
Tactically, they're...
Yeah.
They just fail on every level.
Okay, so... but you made a comment that you thought that... okay, so let me give you a short bit of background that... the voice of America... And I kind of want to get into the sourcing of all of this, too, which I find really weird. But the Voice America, through one of their... I don't know, sections called polygraph.info, acquired from, quote, a source close to the Kremlin, audio of people from the mercenaries calling back to home or wherever and complaining about this, like, you know, we got our fucking asses handed to us and we were thrown into the shit, no one backed us up, no one's defending us, blah, blah, blah. Now, you took that to mean... Or you took an interpretation of that supported the Kremlin's narrative more so than made them seem culpable. Why did you get that?
I was thinking that because I was with the Kremlin, you could say, oh, that was a report. We were receiving information from the field about something we knew nothing about.
Okay. And no one says in there, like, why did you send us in there?
Mm-mm. Because, yeah, if the audio is never like, you did this to us, so why? Yeah. Like, this is just saying, this happened to us.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's fair. So, let's give a little more background here. A big reason why, beyond the ethnicity of the mercenaries, a reason why people do suspect... the Russian government, if not ordering it, at least being tied in with this mercenary group, is because its founder was a former GRU intelligence agent named Dmitry Utkin. The Washington Post is also reporting that he's a Nazi sympathizer, which I just find.
Of course, he is.
Yeah. It's like, and then, anyway, the more interesting name is that there's a group called Evropolis that is supposedly the financier of, I want to get the name correct here. It's, CHVK Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
Is Wagner. Wagner. Yes. Well, that's the Nazi reference right there. Is the Evropolis is the financier. Company, and the person behind Evropolis is Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is actually one of the people indicted by Mueller a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah, that's Putin's chef, right?
Yeah, that's Putin's chef.
Hmm.
And so, That's the logic behind, you know, there's people who are considered some of these oligarchs who are tied into either the intelligence or just business-wise, financially tied in with Putin and the Kremlin, who are behind this. That of course, though, doesn't mean, I mean, beyond, we kind of get bogged down on this with the Mueller investigation, like, did Putin order it? Like, governments are big. It doesn't have to be, like, the main guy who ordered it for it still to be, you know... But did anyone order it from the government? You know, I don't know.
Maybe, but I can only think of one reason why the Russian government would allow this operation to go in the way that it did. like,
go ahead. I'm ready.
On the face of it, it looks like a Syrian operation to show the flag and to try to push the Americans out of Syria. Because now two different countries are occupying parts of Syria with very little reason to ever give it up. And in the case of the American base in eastern Syria near Deir al-Zor, it's near one of their primary air bases and near most of their oil extraction facilities.
What's the other country you're referring to?
Turkey.
Besides the U.S.? Okay, yeah. Well, I will say to that, though, the Russians have been saying that for a lot, which is the Americans are illegally occupying Syrian territory.
Right, which is why they would have allowed, like, on its face, why they would have allowed these mercenaries, Russian citizens, to actively fight against the American government.
Yeah.
But for the Russian military, and especially the GRU, which is Russian Military Intelligence, the reason I can think of that they would want to go along with this is that they were trying to test American tactics and doctrine.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, fuck.
Because, okay, so this, the little, I remember posting about this before and referencing the Little Green Men, mm-hmm. which is, you know, Russian special forces like Shpetsnaz, who are trained by the GRU, and other irregular forces working on behalf of Russian strategic objectives. In Crimea, it was half of a legal formation, like special forces troops that just took their insignias off. But other irregular forces like Wagner and Russian mercenaries were in or are in eastern Ukraine to also accomplish some Russian strategic objectives.
Yeah.
So Wagner is kind of like a special arm in some sense of the government, yes. It's allowing the government to accomplish strategic objectives without having to, you know, put their fingers in the pie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I really... But this is like, I don't know, to my mind, these contradictions kind of are emblematic of our misunderstanding of Russian government and society. It is way more complicated than just saying Putin or Putin's government did it, because there are so many overlapping and competing factions that want very different things over there.
Well, and it could even be something like someone independently wanted to do this to, you know, impress. It, I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be ordered for it still to be done with Russian goals in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Which does change the culpability, of course. But it seems hard to believe that there was... There has to be someone, in my mind, that was Russian, that was doing this to advance Russian goals. Whether that person is a direct agent of the Kremlin or not, I don't know. And I probably won't know.
Hmm. Well, I mean...
But otherwise, it just... Why else would these people be... You know, it's kind of to me like if Eric Prince with Blackwater, you know, he might independently order something without, you know, the CIA or someone telling him to do it, or the Department of Defense or whomever. But it's still... He's still doing it because he thinks that's what should be done.
Sure, and that could be...
That definitely, again, changes the culpability.
Right, and that could be the idea of the leadership behind the corporations. But on a personal note, these mercenaries are fighting over there just to make a paycheck. Russia's economy has been collapsing for a decade now, and if you have a very specialized mm-hmm. and professional skill set, there are very lucrative ways of exploiting that aren't in Russia. Which is, you know, working for these mm-hmm. mercenary organizations.
Oh, yeah, the individuals. Although, you wouldn't go on this mission just to make a...
Well, I mean, that's what they were doing generally. No.
Yeah.
I mean, the company was
although,
probably...
you wonder, who's paying them?
Well, in this case, it was probably the Syrian government.
Yeah.
I mean, they probably have a contract. If judging from, again, our fragmented reporting on this, on these two attacks.
Yeah.
But it looks like it was, yeah, they tried it once, and the Americans just, they didn't necessarily counterattack, but they just returned fire. But the second time they tried, it looks like the Americans counterattacked and just wiped out whole elements of their formation in moments.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, didn't they, like, have an airstrike that just wiped out, like, a whole squadron?
Mm-hmm. Like, they said that the
like,
first
that's where most of the
convoy?
Casualties were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They got within a few hundred yards of the base, and the Air Force was like, okay.
We don't really know, and probably won't for a while until the history books start getting into this. You know, when we have those books on the cause of World War III, we probably really won't know exactly, you know, why did this happen? It's definitely interesting. It's definitely, I think, important, because when you have, regardless of the flag on their, you know, shoulder, when you have Russians fighting Americans, that's newsworthy if it's any time in the past 300 years. What I kind of want to step back a little bit, though, but I find it interesting that this is just a couple weeks after Israel and Iran butting heads in Syria. Or, you know, agents of Iran, or, you know, funded by Iran. It seems to be a...
Well, the Israeli allegation is that they were hitting an Iranian military facility. Or a...
Oh, an official. Oh, okay.
If memory serves.
No, that sounds right. But I mean, it's getting hot over there. It's not cooling down. I mean, you now have... So beyond, we've talked about in a previous episode, all of the different Syrian factions there. You now have shooting going on between Russia... again, we don't know exactly if it's Russia, but... elements somehow loosely connected with Russia and America. Israel and Iran. Turkey and Syria, Turkey and Kurds, then all the ones that have been going on between all the different elements of Syria and America and Russia and...
Yeah.
I mean, this is... When I was in high school, we were in Model UN, and I was on the security council for one of them. And we got this thing laid in front of us, which is, okay, here's a situation going on there. Your job is to prevent nuclear war. And it involved Russia, America, Iran, Israel. And that has always stuck with me. And not necessarily that that exact situation is happening, but I don't remember the details that well. But it seems like a... like, if you were to describe this the right way, it seems like a fabricated beginning of World War III. Like if you were writing the movie, this is the intro.
Yeah.
Talk me down from this ledge, Charles.
These are at this point, these are just territorial encroachments. Like, Turkey's said that they don't want to stay in Syria, although I don't necessarily believe it. The Americans apparently... judging from what Defense Secretary Mattis has said recently, have no interest in ever leaving. And the Israelis only responded with air superiority in this case, although they have apparently been moving the goalposts in the Golan Heights, like, literally moving the fence, but...
Yeah.
That's, like, an incremental encroachment compared to what the Turkish and American militaries are doing right now. So the Syrian coalition, which is, you know, it's easy to say all of these various, well, except maybe the Kurds and Turks problem, but all of this is like the Syrian coalition versus other parties that are on their outskirts. It's tough to say whether or not they'll project power, because, for one, Iran is kind of a side partner, to my mind, although they don't necessarily want to be.
Okay.
Which keeps Israel from being more involved, other than, like, the support for Hezbollah and other ongoing Iranian support. The only thing that I think could severely escalate this situation is that if somebody in the Syrian coalition independently tries to project power beyond Syria, like, say, sending forces into Lebanon to help Hezbollah, which, you know, has shouldered a significant portion of the Syrian coalition's burden of this, of propagating their civil war, 'cause I think I've heard reports that they've lost thousands of fighters in this fight. And so, you know, they probably expect to get something back out of it.
Okay. So you're saying as long as it stays in Syria, it stays in Syria.
Well, and that's the other thing. If one of these countries like Turkey or America or Israel suddenly does something more serious to, shall we say, attack government control over the population? Mm-hmm. Like, if the Americans try to set up an administration in Deir al-Zor, that's definitely got to be a red line for them. And that will also further escalate the situation. So it's, there's two different lines of escalation, and neither of them seem like it approachable, but who's to say at this point? I didn't think Russian mercenaries were going to be attacking Americans a month ago, so might as well just roll the dice.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so I still see the edge, but I'm not right on it. Okay. I can deal with that.
All right, welcome back to Tell Me What You Think. I'm here with a special segment with our lawyer friend, Dave Egan, because I'm not a lawyer and not expert enough to tell you what to think on this matter. We did find an expert. So, Dave, the Supreme Court is having a busy term this year. Currently, they're deciding a major case regarding union rights. Can you tell me a little bit about what to think?
So the current case is Janus versus American Federation of State, Municipal, and County Employees. The issue is about whether or not non-union members can be charged the agency fees to keep the union running. The idea basically is that even if you're not in the union, you still benefit from the union's advocacy with the increased wages and benefits and that sort of thing. And if you're not compelled to pay, then no one's going to pay the union dues, and then the union won't exist, and you'll lose the benefits. So there's a so this guy Janus is suing to not have to pay the $45 in monthly fees to his union
because he doesn't want to associate with the union. From my understanding, is that correct?
I don't know anything about his ideological leanings in this. I mean, you would think that obviously he's an anti-union person, but yeah, he's chosen not to associate with the union politically. And his argument is that this is a violation of his free speech rights, that he's being compelled to speak in the way that the union is speaking by supporting them financially.
And before our discussion, before we started recording, you were talking about some of the main precedent that the Supreme Court is looking into in this case.
Yeah, the underlying rule that it exists right now, which Janus is asking the Supreme Court to overturn, is Abood versus Detroit. And that involved teachers that likewise didn't want to pay the union fees, and they argued that it violated their First Amendment right of freedom to associate.
Okay, and so how did the Supreme Court respond to them?
So, about 40 years ago in this case, the Supreme Court held that the fees were okay only insofar as they were for the union's administrative fees, for the things that actually generate the benefit, the negotiating for the contracts and that sort of thing. but that the union could separate out its political action fees, and that people that chose not to join the union could only be forced to pay the administrative fees.
Okay, so that would be like you enjoy the benefits of the workplace, but you don't necessarily agree with the political points that the union is trying to organize behind.
Right. Like, if you've ever worked in a union shop, you see the options presented for you when you decide whether or not you want to join the union. And they show you $1 amount that says, this is how much you'll have to pay if you don't join the union, and then there's this larger dollar amount that you have to pay if you choose to join the union. And like you said, that's a choice to endorse the political action and opinions of the union that's going to be representing you.
Right, and I assume you get a t-shirt to wear at their political events for the extra cost.
Yeah, and you become a voting member of the union, and you can have your voice heard on directing the policy of the union.
Which would be those wage negotiations, potentially.
Right.
Okay, so let's use that to go into what's currently being considered. Tell me what you think.
Well, what's currently being considered is the Supreme Court is being asked to overturn that distinction between the political action fees and the administrative fees that the union can charge. Because Janice's argument in this case is that even those administrative tasks and those administrative fees inherently force him to support the political action of the union. And it seems like many of the judges agree. I mean, we had a case like this out of California last year, and the Supreme Court couldn't come to a decision. It was 4-4 split on the what are traditionally called the liberal and conservative sides of the court. And unfortunately, Justice Scalia passed before that decision could be made. And so the Supreme Court was evenly split, and the new judge that takes that place. Right. And many people expect that he's going to come down on the side of rejecting these union fees.
Okay, so walk me through what the individual members are thinking. And for our listeners, it's a bit of a misnomer to apply the political adjectives of liberal and conservative to the opinions of the Supreme Court.
Right, an example of that is Justice Kennedy in this case. Justice Kennedy has been the swing vote on a lot of the social issue cases, like the gay marriage cases. He was sided with what's called the liberal side of the court. But in this case, he's siding against the liberal side of the court with the quote-unquote conservative side of the court for these union fees. Because he thinks that the free rider problem is the key to defeating the union's arguments here. Like, he thinks that the unions are giving up too much in their case by saying that if there are free riders, there will be less membership, and therefore they will be less politically effective. And so he thinks, so therefore, these agency fees must be supporting the political actions of the union.
Because of the fungibility of money.
Right. And I think because of... he's arguing that what the union is giving up here is, in their argument, is that it is contained in the free rider problem, is that there's the... Kennedy's saying, like, if people actually care about your political positions and are freely joining the union and paying the higher fees to support the union's political position, then those people aren't going to be impacted by the free rider problem. They're not going to choose not to pay, because they're getting the benefit they want by supporting the political action of the union. And so the union's not going to experience any real financial loss from not having to receive the agency fees from these non-union people.
It seems a little contradictory on its face, but okay.
Yeah, and it's not... I mean, it's not an insane argument, but it's sort of glosses over the real financial pressures at stake when, you know, and the demonstrated evidence that in states that have implemented right-to-work laws that eliminate these agency fees, union membership plummets. And I think the missing component of that argument is that if you're not forced to pay for the union at all, then if you can get the benefits of the union entirely for free, then there's no reason to pay the extra money so that your voice can be heard in union governance.
Okay. I mean, that, again, doesn't seem necessarily insane.
Right.
Okay, so the real, to my mind, the real issue with this case is that some of the justices seem to be, well, for instance, I think you said Justice Roberts was looking at how this, no, I'm probably misspeaking this, but some of the justices are saying that the fact that the union negotiates for pay and wages, that is inherently political activity because they're impacting the state budget.
Yeah, that was Justice Roberts' argument, or that appears to have been the angle he's taking on this case, is that since the union negotiation on wages impacts the budget, then that's inherently a political activity, which also seems to be the underlying one of the Kennedy arguments and the Roberts arguments seem to be the underlying arguments that Janus is making in this case, is that it's unavoidable that union activity is political.
Well, politics by nature is just the simple association of people, and so an extension of that would be a union is just another association of people which I guess kind of advocates for its particular issues and point of view.
Right. And even though he's benefiting from this this union, he's arguing that he's politically opposed to them.
This seems like a really murky issue.
Yeah.
The more you think about it, the more you find yourself in rhetorical quicksand.
Right.
So, do you think how do you think the court is going to decide? Do you think they're going to come in favor of obviously they're probably going to rule against the union in this case.
I think so, and that seems to be the easy money is making that argument, because it seems like the argument is going, and the way the judges are speaking, that their opinions haven't changed in the last year, and the legal narrow road in the middle is the existing precedent, and since that's the thing that the Supreme Court has chosen to hear argument on, that alone is a signal that they're willing to overturn their existing precedent.
And that's basically what this, even beside the political theater, the astroturfing, and the individual points of view, that's almost always what the Supreme Court is concerned about, the jurisprudence of the matter.
Right. Yeah, they can be uniquely myopic when it comes to boiling things down to a narrow legal issue that can have wide-ranging effects.
Okay.
Which was Justice Kagan's argument, is that this is going to lead to chaos, where every state and local union contract is going to have to be renegotiated after this case.
And that typically would keep the Supreme Court from intervening in any drastic way, correct?
It's what led to their decisions on Obamacare. Their decisions were narrowly tailored to avoid chaos.
Okay, so talking about those AstroTurf groups, what exactly do they get out of supporting the argument on one side?
Well, presumably these are conservative groups that are supported by
libertarian organizations, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. People that generally are ideologically opposed to the notion of unions, and the public sector has been a bulwark of union organization since the right to work movement has swept the country.
Right, it's the the last vestige of union dedicated union support.
Right, like police and teacher unions are the last place where you can expect unionization of people, and that's keeping the spirit of unions alive.
So on one hand, it looks like the unions have their back against the wall trying to fight for the last bit of territory that they have, and on the other side, it seems like the libertarians are finally getting ultimately what they've always wanted out of this. Well, out of their legalistic approach to busting unions.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they're even going for this case at all indicates that this is sort of a coup de grace or a finishing move or the last, you know, cornering unions into a corner.
So, I guess, broadly, what is your opinion? Do you think that union protections are going to go away after this? Probably not in any generic or general sense, but certainly some specific union protections.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, is the last place that we'll see unions drop away from are going to be police unions, because that's going to be a narrow political needle that will have to be thread between conservative principles of supporting the police and, you know, the blue line, and you know, conservative principles of obliterating workers' rights and collective bargaining.
Right, it's tough to square. If you really care about municipal budgets, how do you not take aim at the police unions and their ridiculous pension costs?
Right. Well, that would be a principled argument, and I don't think any of these are based on any principle other than the capacity to profiteer off of exploited workers.
Oh, so this is purely an economic argument in some respect, then. It's just another part of the race to the bottom.
Yeah, this is absolutely the race to the bottom. Anything else that's left, any other unionized jobs that are left in the country are going to be eliminated by automation. But, you know, getting rid of the idea of unions, you have to get rid of them from public employees.
I slightly disagree with your previous point, but yeah, it's the narrow aspect of the ascendant, but yes, I agree that this is absolutely an attack against unions in the broadest general sense, which is why it's at the Supreme Court. Anything to add about the individual justices' opinions about this and where this might lead to next?
I mean, the mystery is Gorsuch, at least theoretically, because he hasn't spoken during oral argument. But I think if you look at his previous body of work, and if you look at the political groups that ask him to come and speak and attend their events, you could pretty easily divine what his result is going to be.
This may seem like a complete out of... Like, your remark kind of leads me to another tangent, but I know Clarence Thomas is typically known as the silent justice, but is it weird that Gorsuch hasn't spoken in oral arguments yet?
I don't know that he hasn't spoken in oral arguments at all. I just know that it was... Since he's the one vote that we haven't seen yet on this specific issue, he was the focus of a lot of speculation yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so it was particularly notable that he didn't show his cards at all.
Are there any other Supreme Court happenings that the listeners should be or have on their radar?
Did you want to talk about the juxtaposition of the last 2 days for when it comes to illegal immigration?
Sure, I hadn't heard about this, so tell me what to think.
So yesterday, the Supreme Court denied cert in the fast track for the Dreamers case, because the Trump administration wanted the Supreme Court to hurry up and get rid of the challenges to their removal of the Obama-era regulations on the Dreamers.
I hate to interrupt, but you just used an incredibly arcane legal term there.
Which one?
The denied cert. I know that's a legal abbreviation, so...
It means the Supreme Court refused to hear the case.
Okay.
But today, so everyone was happy that that case wasn't fast-tracked. But more sober forces were like, hey man, this case still exists. We didn't win yet. You know, we still need to keep pushing for the fight. But today, the Supreme Court released an opinion in another immigration case. But anyway, the Supreme Court decided a case where an illegal immigrant had been detained in California pending deportation. And detentions pending deportation can be long and protracted because those courts are understaffed and overworked like all of our federal courts. And that was the reason for the Dreamers Initiative in the Obama administration, because there were
cases that were clogging up the pipeline, basically.
Yeah, there were cases that were clogging up the pipeline, and these are the cases that it's easiest to take a moral stance on, where it's like, we don't need to imprison these people forever. They're not criminals. They're basically Americans. They're helping us. They're paying taxes. You know, these people that we can easily separate out from any other problem that's involved with illegal immigration, these are the ones that are the least priority for dealing with.
Right, because they had no agency in the decision to become, to cross the border illegally, which is...
Oh, yeah. Well, there's all kinds of reasons to leave the Dreamers alone. Mm-hmm. Like, they're participating in America as citizens. They're paying taxes. They're working. They're not criminals. Everything is fine. That's not the case with the person in this underlying case. He wasn't one of the Dreamers, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But he was basically indefinitely being held in detention pending his deportation hearing. And there was... And so he brought a habeas corpus action that said, you can't hold me here forever. I need to know when I'm going to be left, or you need to put me out on bail. And the relevant statute does give the Attorney General the authority to release these people that are in detention on bail.
Right, but limits that to the Attorney General, right?
Yeah, the wording of the statute limits it to the Attorney General, but he could delegate the authority to, you know, an assistant or...
whichever deputy AG oversees immigration courts.
Right. In the way that, you know, the AG delegates his other authorities, you know, to his chief lieutenants. So, the Ninth Circuit ruled that, you know, the Due Process Clause says you can't just hold someone indefinitely, even if they're a non-citizen. And so it set a six-month limit before there could be a habeas hearing, and before bond had to be posted. And the Supreme Court overturned that case today.
Basically giving the administration a free hand in its immigration detention practices.
Basically.
Wow, okay, so immigrants once captured, not captured, but detained by ICE, can now be held in any number of immigration facilities indefinitely.
I haven't read the full opinion from today, but that seems to be the case. Usually the Supreme Court gives more guidance after their holding, but the holding was specifically just that the Ninth Circuit is overturned.
And so talk about chaos. What is California supposed to do in the wake of this?
Well, I guess they're just going to... Well, California, I mean, they're already...
Yeah, they have a complicated relationship with immigration policy, admittedly.
Yeah, they're in a very complicated position. But ICE can keep doing whatever they want.
Well, that's a depressing note to leave it off on. Well, thanks, Dave, for helping me record this special segment of Tell Me What to Think.
Yeah, I think I get to put on my CV that I'm a senior legal affairs correspondent.
Absolutely. All right, I'd like to thank our listeners, especially our one fan out there. I've been Charles Minnick at Green Weird, and Dave?
I'm David Egan, and you can find me at Drunk Leo Cetus.
last week in the episode I recorded with the Mr. Dave Egan, I alluded to a rant I wanted to do about Peter Thiel, so I'm going to do that now. He has a company called Palantir, which has a contract with, correct me if I'm wrong, Charles, with the NSA, I believe?
Yeah, and the CIA, if memory serves.
And it's like an it's like a information gathering software.
It's like an indexing and visualization software for intelligence.
Yeah.
Like, it combines a bunch of different sources and makes it legible, basically, to the analyst in front of the screen.
Yes. So, on that surface, calling your company Palantir, which is a reference to Lord of the Rings, makes sense. Right, on every other fucking level, it's stupid and probably more likely not stupid, but evil.
Right, just outright evil. For our listeners, Palantir is the eye that Sauron uses to survey the entire world.
Well, yeah, it's these stones that were created by elves in, I believe, their island utopia, that were then sent with some, given to mostly humans, actually. And so, there's a lot of backstory. And I actually just watched, there's a cool Lord of the Rings YouTube series by an account, Men of the West, which if you're looking for just good analysis in easy snippets, it's a really good series. And so he did one on the Palantir, so that's where I'm getting some of this from. And the Palantirs were given to the Numenoreans. Numenorea was destroyed. Numenor was destroyed, so they take them all to Middle-earth. There's two kingdoms in Middle-earth of humans, and between the two kingdoms, all these Palantir were put. Now, that's all fine. That's all fine. If that were the end of the story, fine. Call your utopian information modeling company Palantir. Great.
Excuse me.
Great. Everything beyond that is fucking terrible. So, in, what is it, the Northern Kingdom, if it's like Ardor or something, they all get lost to war as they're attacked by the bad guys that predate Sauron. I think it is Sauron actually still at that point, in the Second Age. But anyways, the communication breaks down and they all get lost. Every one after another. If that were the end of the story, okay, maybe. Now everything after that is even worse. In Gondor, they get lost to war, but then also one of them gets in the hands of the bad guys. And after that, the remaining ones all get corrupted by the big, bad, evil eye of Sauron. And because the way a Palantir works is, and this is actually where it gets a little bit into the stupid side of calling the company Palantir, where it's not an apt metaphor, which is Sauron primarily uses it to kind of surveil the world and corrupt, you know, human and elements. But the problem is that the Palantir is really more it's supposed to be for communication. It's supposed to be two-way communication. So I have one here, you have one there. More like what we're doing right now with audio programs. We talk back and forth. The problem with it is that it cannot see into darkness. So the way they kind of eventually figured out to you can't look into mine is that you just put like a cloth over it. But the thing is that darkness is where bad guys are. And so you can't use it to surveil bad guys, but bad guys can use it to surveil you and corrupt you.
Oh, maybe that's why the metaphor works so well.
I know.
Bad guys.
No, they're not. And also, once you have the willpower to use the Palantir, you view what you want to see, not what you need to see. Which is another problem with it. Oof. So it's not really showing you you know, it's user directed, which then has the same flaws as humans, of course.
And, you know, the modern Palantir, it's still subject to the analysis or analysts.
Exactly. So anyways, it's supposed to be used for communication, but that's not what this, the Palantir program is. It's not two-way communication between all of us and the NSA and the NSA and all of us. It's only going one way. They take information from us and look at it and analyze it. And so, yeah, and then obviously it's corrupted. It's eventually in the end, surprise, surprise, this super powerful tool, like all other super powerful tools, well, not totally, but all, by all the really powerful tools in Lord of the Rings, get corrupted by the bad guys and used for evil ends.
Predictably.
Yes, yeah, surprise, surprise. And for someone to name this super powerful tool who's a, quote, Lord of the Rings fan.
I don't believe you, Peter Thiel.
Like, he's not an idiot, right? He's not stupid.
Notionally, yeah.
Like, I mean, unless his form of stupidity is that he doesn't understand themes of great literature, and he just, you know, he knows Elvish, but he has no understanding of the, you know, the fall of Findar or whoever, or Fingolfin, I can't remember them all. But, like, it's so stupid. All, like, the Cimmarils, the Rings, the Palantir, in Lord of the Rings, they all get corrupted by the bad guys. And so to make a reference to that either acknowledges that you don't understand the themes of the book, and you don't acknowledge that it will be corrupted by bad guys, or you're a fucking bad guy.
Right, you're just okay with it being bad.
You are the bad guy. And so, like, I don't need more evidence to think that Peter Thiel's fucking evil.
Hmm.
He probably has a lot of great things to say. Probably, I know he has a lot of terrible things to say. I don't really need to hear him because he doesn't understand Lord of the Rings. So fuck that guy. I can't. Like, what is this other company called? The One Ring? Or, you know.
Are you kidding me?
No, I don't know. No, I'm kidding. Or called.
He said his private security, his personal security and firm. Like, you can make yourself invisible from the deep web. Oh, God, I just did... stop talking, Charles.
Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, that was my rant that I just wanted to get down on wax. I also want to talk about some embarrassing Wisconsin update. Hashtag embarrassing Wisconsin. This has actually been for a while now, but I don't think we've talked about it on the paper yet or on the podcast yet. That Scott Walker in our beloved Wisconsin is not calling special elections in one state Senate and one state assembly district in Wisconsin. And this morning or yesterday, this group started by former Attorney General Eric Holder filed suit in Wisconsin to force the governor to hold elections. So, what do you think about that, Charles?
Like the voter ID thing, it just disgusts me and is so painful that the notional opposition party isn't spearheading this more directly. Like, notionally, yeah. This should be, like, one of the things that the Democrat Party is supposed to do, like, cover the legal fees to do these strategic pushes against established authority. And pointing out to the rest of us why this shit is fucking terrible.
Yeah. And so the argument from Walker has been, well, and at this point, there's only like a month left in the legislative session, functionally speaking.
Right. But in this time, he was able to, like, what, devastate welfare in Wisconsin? Did they impose the drug tests on everything, except up to including housing assistance?
He's been delaying this for a couple months, so it's. I mean, you know, you can't just hold an election like the next day. It is more complicated than that. But these are two small places that you'd be having special elections. This is not a statewide election. But his logic is that there's not much time, and it costs taxpayer dollars
and so we can't afford to have an election. Which,
but we can afford to fucking have fly him between fucking Madison and Milwaukee like on a fucking whim.
Yeah. How many flights does it take to equal an election in Lodi?
Like two.
So I have a feeling you're going to start seeing this taxpayer reason, this taxes that elections cost money. I think that's slowly going to be brought up more and more as we sink into authoritarianism and the death of democracy.
Yeah, it's really easy to export that idea and to be like, oh, well, we just can't have elections.
We can't afford elections.
We've starved the government, and we now have no money to do anything, so...
We lowered corporate taxes. We're $20 trillion in debt. We can't afford to have another presidential election.
Right, we're going to have to borrow...
It'll cost too much money.
We're going to have to borrow $1.5 trillion this year. You want me to add another $30 million onto that to have to get your views represented in our Republican democracy? Get out of here.
Incumbents mostly win anyway, so why do we even have to have the election? It's just wasting taxpayer dollars.
Right? The people will know the will of the... or the people will have their will imposed upon them by government officials. You don't know what you want. Let us explain it to you.
Once again, Wisconsin's starting to be a leader in the death of democracy.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, and while we're on the topic, a special reverse shout-out, I guess, to that Atomwaffen group. The Atomwaffen Division.
What is that?
Oh, it's, remember that picture I posted on, I posted about this on Twitter yesterday? There was a map that was posted about the 23 different states that this neo-Nazi group is, represented in, and Wisconsin is one of them, so fuck you guys.
Yeah, so this is a neo-Nazi white supremacist. They actually killed one of them killed a gay Jewish student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then they were all, like...
glad-handing about it.
Yeah. Good job there. Yeah. And they have, like, the worst nicknames ever, these fucking people that unfortunately look like you and I. God damn it. We're not white supremacists. But yeah, they have the worst nicknames. Like, their handles online are, like, Rape and Commissar.
Yeah, which, you know, that, like we were talking about, or you guys talked about last weekend, this weaponized indecency, they're embracing that whole mantle, like, even to make them themselves further distinct from people who are just kind of bigoted.
Yeah, and at some level it starts having, like a self-corrosive effect. It's like, once you decide to cross some sort of line, it just seems to, like, snowball more and more stupidity and hatred into their brains.
Once you agree with one of their points, that just kind of breaks you down so you can start agreeing with their other points.
Yeah. Any other news you wanted to cover coming up, or anything that happened in the past week you think is worth mentioning here?
I mean, I guess we can laugh at the notion that Trump would have gone into Parkland high school in Parkland to save those people, whether or not he had a weapon. I mean, the guy who got 5 deferrals to avoid fighting Vietnam suddenly finds personal courage.
Yeah. So what I find it, I mean, there've been a lot of takes on showing his kind of, you know, like there's the thing with the bald eagle that scared him and that like promo there, and then there was I saw one that was like, he was talking about some sort of instance where he walked away from a bleeding man at his club. all these FBI agents were like rushing in to help, and he just like casually walked away and complained about the mess. But what I found interesting about that quote, because we all know how terrible Trump is, not brave, not altruistic, clearly. It's stupid, the idea that you'd run in without a gun is, you know, stupid
on his face.
I mean, what he was doing is he's trying to use self-aggrandizing hypocrisy to attack the deputy who didn't go in. It's just really stupid. What I found interesting was, I believe in his quote, he said something like, like, I think a lot of us would have done this, or you and I, or, you know, like, he was, I took it, he's so stupid, he's advocating for unarmed people to run into mass shootings. In a vain attempt to, what, tackle the person with the gun? I don't really get it. What is he? What did you? What do you do once you're there?
Yeah, it's. I mean, at most you could help evacuate people, but that's mostly keeping yourself between the notional victims and the shooter to provide that, you know, personal shield. But
yeah.
That's really
like,
the only...
Like, I mean, he didn't say to rescue people. I mean, he didn't really say what, I guess.
No, he was notionally advocating people to attack him, but tactically, why would you run up on somebody who's actively shooting and taking aim at people? You want to make yourself a better target? It's stupid on its face.
Yeah.
Because most people's logical reaction, like that police officer, is to hide in fear... And find cover.
Yeah, which... It's a shame. Maybe he could have stopped something earlier.
Sure, maybe. I don't... None of us are in that position to say whether or not he could have. I mean... Okay, so... Picture this. You're that cop, right? You're sitting there, you hear somebody shooting, or you hear of shooting in a different part of the building. It's... So you have to approach a shooter in a tactical situation, which is, again, difficult because you don't have any communication. Like, if you could look at the tweets and communications coming out of the students, but that would take your tactical or, you know, further cost you time in a potentially dangerous tactical situation. Okay, so say you do encounter this guy. He is in a crowded hallway with a bunch of kids who... If you're facing the shooter, are probably running towards you. And so you have to shoot through this crowd at that shooter. There's no way that's a tactically feasible position.
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that has been, that I've wanted to know about all this is what was that policeman trained to do?
That's another interesting question.
Because I'm not so sure that it was, you know, as you're saying, just run in. Now, I haven't heard the sheriff effectively, and maybe I just haven't, he's been doing a lot of interviews, which I really think he needs to stop doing. Get some reports down, get some final analysis down, get something on paper before you start going on CNN, at this point at least.
Well,
now that his agency is under attack.
Sure, but he's elected. He's just trying to stay ahead of a PR storm.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right. He is an elected official, yeah. Well, either way, I'm just curious as to what that guy was trained to do and how that training maybe needs to be changed, or if he didn't follow his training, and how we need to more specifically train for things. I mean,
this kind of situation highlights the difference between military and law enforcement training. In the military, you're trained to move through cover and take tactically advantageous positions and to, you know, work with a coordinated group to achieve a military objective. But law enforcement, your whole purpose is to de-escalate a situation and to protect people and property, although not necessarily in that order.
Because when I first heard that, my thought was actually there was a shooting at that Sikh temple in Oak Creek 6-7 years ago, and if I recall correctly, and I apologize if I'm recalling incorrectly, I thought they all just showed up, the cops, and they were all waiting outside. Like, there might have been one there who got there first and was shot or something.
Well, I think the guy opened up by shooting the security guard who was already at the temple, if memory serves.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, from what that was my understanding, too, is that they evacuated the temple and waited him out.
Yeah. And so... And so I'm not even saying that that's the, you know, in this situation that the deputy in the end did the right thing, but I just find it, I'm not so sure he didn't do what he was trained to do. Yeah. And I think it's really unfair. And then, of course, yeah, back to the president, of course. It's super unfair. But that's what he does. The president gives unfair criticism all the time. That's like his, he thinks that's his job.
Right, he creates and exploits these divisions between segments of American society.
Yeah, when there are complicated, tough things that we need to grapple with in this country, he picks a side and abuses the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he finds, like, the smallest, like, individual or, like, element that he can to single out.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, you find a little chink.
And
it might not even be a real chink. It's just something that you can spin to look like a chink in the armor.
Right, and then you can sink all of the blame and doubt right into that person, and, you know, away from the Trump, or away from Trump and his administration.
Yep. Yep. All right. Well, it's been a fun episode. I'm Peter Elber. You can find me on Twitter at Bloated Nemesis.
And I'm Charles Minnick. You can find me at green_weird, W-Y-R-D, on Twitter.
All right, see y'all next week. Break your chains.